The book is The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser, Chapter the Ninth. It was towards dusk of a balmy tropic Friday when the cursed hell ship Frantic Frog came gliding out of the setting sun, her tasseled sails limp in the sultry evening air, and dropped anchor with a colossal splash and a shriek from one member of her crew who hadn't let go in time, on the edge of the Isle of Ave's Lagoon. In the drawing-room of her lovely bower, Lady Vanity heard the distant clank of the chain and with a muttered, "About time, too," flung aside her year-old copy of Vogue, for Avery had omitted naught for her comfort, and moved with graceful yet petulant stride to the bamboo window. Yes, there was a ship at anchor, and this would be him, hours late, and the corned beef omelette and pawpaw mousse, which she had so lovingly and inexpertly prepared, would be respectively flatter than old beer and curdled in its cowrie shell. Well, he could ruddy well eat them anyway, coming home at this hour when he'd promised to be punctual. And if he thought that the fact that he'd obviously captured one of the pirates was any excuse, he could think again. It was jolly sickening, and her all glamoured up to welcome him in the red bikini which she had woven painstakingly during the week from jungle blossoms, all for his delight, rot his boots. Across the water, a boat was pulling toward shore, and Vanity's pouting lips parted in sudden surprise. She couldn't make out the rowers, but they were undoubtedly singing Mademoiselle from Armentières, and her beloved would never have permitted such continental levity, surely? A sudden shiver of apprehension flapped the hibiscus blossom behind her shapely right ear, and her blue eyes widened in alarm as she stared at the distant forepeak of the anchored ship. Could that be a black flag, a skull and crossbones surmounted by a capering frog with a frilly tricolour undergarment in its paw and the dread legend Vive le Sport underneath? Vanity drew in a sharp breath, and with it inhaled a distant drift of hair oil. That did it. Avery wasn't even late. The selfish rotter hadn't arrived at all, and instead she was at the mercy of beastly foreigners, including, almost certainly, that ghastly person who had ogled her in her shorty nightdress aboard the 12 Apostles. Sure enough, as the boat grounded, she could hear them singing, "Milor," and a hatefully remembered voice was exclaiming, "So, we return ourselves from the lifeboat trip avec plaisir. Mama likes not the sea, and rests sur le pont, et là. Has papa purchased to himself the tickets? Mais non, le douanier has trouvé papa's packet of smuggled heroin and called les flatties. We mount for to seek places in the paddy wagon. Ah, mais que c'est drôle." By this time, Trembling Beauty was leafing frantically through the instruction leaflet which Avery had left her in case of emergencies. Her slender fingers flew through the pages. In case of fire, burst pipes, headhunters, dizzy spells, how to pickle yams. Here it was. "And there comes knaves to ye isle, lewd fellows bent on mischief. Seek not concealment, lest they rootle ye out. So should ye be undone, but rather attire thyself right smartly as a barbaric native female or Hottentot, and which ye may do by staining thy flesh and hair with juice or galupa nuts boiled. Therewith shall ye be darkened. Then venturing boldly forth, if any stay or question thee, answer only, Me aloma, me good girl, that hearing the which they may take thee for a savage and be satisfied, and so pass by. But in no case answer, Me tondaleo, me bad girl, lest shame and ill usage befall thee." Galupa nuts! In a trice she had them simmering on the hob, watching the dark liquid bubble as the distant tread of booted feet crunched across the shingle. Happy Dan Pugh's voice was upraised in altercation with an imaginary hotel manager who had refused him entrance to the salle à manger because it was after 10h15, while his raucous followers were now singing Auprès de ma blonde, which to the terrified vanity sounded horribly prophetic. In haste, she plunged her golden tresses into the stew, but before she could proceed to staining her skin, there fell a thunderous crash of pistol butts on the front door, followed by, Knock, knock, who is there? Absinthe, absinthe who? Absinthe makes the heart grow fonder. The French filibusters fell about in childish glee and began to kick the door in. And with a sob of panic, Vanity, now a rather damp brunette, fled through the back door to the concealment of the jungle. She crouched, toweling her hair and peering through the fronds at the hideous havoc being wrecked on her little bower by the brutish invaders. With disgusted oaths, they sampled her corned beef omelette with rude cries of Quelle horreur! They flung her pawpaw mousse into the bin. With lustful whistles they tore the corset ads from Vogue, and finally, having reduced themselves to staggering confusion with reckless draughts of the galupa juice, which they supposed to be some choice native drink, they built a fire on the beach and had a sing-song. Vanity trembled and covered her ears. What subhuman wretches were these, and what must be her fate when they found her? Even with her thought, there rose a cry of Cherchez la femme! And urged on by Happy Dan Pugh, who advised them to look under the buffet, les fauteuils, le tabouret, les coussins, et le tapis de table. He was in his familiar things in the living room stage by now. They began to advance on the jungle, horrible bearded figures in culottes and buckled shoes and floppy hats, brandishing torches and cutlasses and shouting, Youhou! Belle fille d'admiral! Nous vous cherchons, ready or not! Un, deux, trois, allons! Vive la blonde bombshell anglaise! Swiftly arranging her coal-black hair in an elegant bouffant, Vanity strove to remember her instructions. She must sally out boldly and pass herself off as a native wench, but would her jungle blossom bikini pass muster as authentic savage costume? Well, whatever the locals wore, it wouldn't be twin-set in pearls. If only she had a basket of breadfruit to go over her arm and a bone through her nose. Drawing herself proudly erect, the pearl of English womanhood took a deep breath, hastily replaced her bikini top, murmured, Chin chin chingo, Cheltenham ra ra ra, walked through the bushes and out on to the beach. There wasn't a pirate in sight. They were all plunging blindly through the jungle, crying, Ella! And getting their Wellingtons full of water, falling over branches, blundering into thickets, and squealing when crawly things slipped down their collars. The only figure in the fire glow was a tattered specimen, swinging by his thumbs from an improvised gallows humming Galway Bay, and giving an occasional anguished groan. Vanity peered at him doubtfully, cleared her throat, and said hopefully, Me Aloma, me good girl.
"'Are ye hellas like?'
snapped the hanging figure.
"'Colonel Blood!' exclaimed Vanity, her hand flying to her parted lips. "'Ah, what shall this portend, and what are you doing up there? "'What the divil does it look like?' was the sarcastic reply. "'If I can chin myself 100 times on this bar, the pirates have promised to let me go, ye brainless biddy!' he added violently. I'm strung up here because I'm a prisoner, and like to be carbonadoed by these hellions, and you come primping along as if you were in the last three of Miss World and ask damn fool questions. Cut me down afore my thumbs come loose, can't you?
Why,
"Art well served for a turncoat," cried haughty Vanity, and set him swinging with an indignant push. "Who beetled off and left us in the boat, you rotter? Of all the sneaky tricks, ay, and whipped my dear one's piece of the Madagascar crown, and gutsed all the tinned pears, and I'm not primping along like Miss World. I am disguised as a jungle maiden, so there." "You wouldn't fool an infant," cried Blood. "And what the divil have you done to your hair?"
"Galupa juice," said Vanity.
"Like it?"
"Not bad," gasped Blood, writhing. "Mind, it doesn't suit you well as blonde, with your milkmaid complexion."
"And blue eyes, of course. But you're quite right. It's the flesh tint that's really important."
"That's a fact," whimpered the Colonel. "Although given a touch, oh, Jesus, my poor thumbs, a touch of the sun."
"Well, perhaps, but only a smidgen and lashings of amber solaire, or I'll look like a beetroot."
"To be sure, just a light tan, and the new hair-coloured toad is a fair treat."
"Prithee," groaned the pendant rascal, "get a knife and cut me down, or I am like to croak untimely."
"Well," said Vanity severely, "it would serve you jolly well right if I didn't, because you've behaved like an absolute beast. But dost truly think I would show to advantage in the Miss World competition its finals? True, this costume is but sorry makeshift.
You could win wearing dungarees and with a paper bag o'er your head," babbled Blood, dangling in anguish. "A knife, a cushla, quick as you can."
"All right, hang about," said Manity, a trifle tactlessly, and discovering a convenient snickersnee among the pirate's litter. She had just sawed through his bonds and brought him to the sand in a complaining heap when uproar broke out on the jungle edge. Vanity turned in dismay. Blood scurried on all fours to the concealment of a couple of rum casks, and out onto the beach swarmed a gesticulating mob of pirates. Fed up with blundering around, they had turned back, and now they swooped on their hapless prey with triumphant whoops of "C'est her là! Elle était ici tout le temps! Ah, méchante blondie, come to papa!" Rough hands seized her, bearded faces leered, eye patches flapped, waves of garlic made her senses swim, and hoots of derision greeted her pathetic plea that she was a luma and a good girl.
"Do not attempt to pull our eyes over your sweater," bawled a burly Breton. "You are no hula hula girl, although it's not a bad idea by example. Si, mon capitaine, here is le bébé fantastique, milady Vanity Rook, en bikini formidable, et en perruque noire très kinky, n'est-ce pas?"
Through the raffish throng minced Happy Dan Pugh, brave in galloons and flounces, one ring-bedecked hand on hilt or rapier, the other raising quizzing glass to view the supple body writhing in the cruel grasp of his followers. He lamped the shapely form, the proud loveliness of feature, the glossy blackness of the bouffant coiffure, and above all the crimson perfection of the cupid's bow lips. A moment he gaped, gulped like a throttled ferret, dropped his quizzing glass, staggered, and clutched his brow.
"Non, Dame Mirchon, what is this?" he cried, distraught. "Par la grande règle de Monsieur Cladel, le professeur, it is she, her, elle, le hairdo brunette, les lips rouges, les cœurs extraordinaires, tous les works as depicted by Monsieur H.M. Brock."
He glared in frenzy at his crew. "Ce n'est pas ma lady vanity, bombheads. C'est ma grande amour, la femme j'ai been cherching ever since la classe to be moderne. Ah, chérie, j'ai trouvé de vous at last." He fell to his knees and rained passionate kisses on Vanity's toes, panting out his adoration.
Ce petit cochon went to market. Ce petit cochon stayed home. Ce petit cochon avait roast beef. Je suis tué, il est, elle est, ah, how ill she est. Hands clasped in entreaty, he gazed rapturously up at her. Parlez-vous français, doll? Then parlez-moi, ma belle, ma jeune fille avec la grande bouche. The words trembled fearfully on his ashen lips. Petite pomme? Convinced that he had at long last gone harpic beyond redemption, his buccaneers stared at each other in embarrassment. Vanity was at a loss. Why should a dark dye job have rendered her an object of worship to this grotesque French fruitcake? Petite pomme? Something stirred in her powder-puff brain, a memory of school days, guzzling marshmallows and reading Angela Brazil in the back row during French. Yes, a lesson about some snooty-looking piece who did facial exercises before the mirror and chundered on about fruit. What was it again? Another catchphrase. She hesitated nervously, viewing the love-smitten headbanger nuzzling her insteps. Petite poire? She ventured, and promptly wished she hadn't, for with an ecstatic yell of Chaussier! Happy Dan bounded to his feet, swept her into his embrace, rained burning kisses on her upturned face, flung her half-swooning over his shoulder, and bore her forthwith aboard his vessel, or rather, he didn't quite, because emotion and vanity's well-nourished charms brought him exhausted to his knees before he got halfway down the beach, and they both had to be carried aboard by his grumbling crew. Vanity, unconscious with terror, and Happy Dan, burbling dementedly about bridal cabins and honeymoon cruises, whereafter the frantic frog stood out of the Aves lagoon, cleaving the purple swell with Vanity once again in the amorous clutches of a pitiless sea-wolf, and a doolily one at that, and no hope of succor unless. Toiling in the vessel's wake, and just catching hold of her rudder before she moved into overdrive, came the forgotten man, for in all the excitement the lubberly matelots had overlooked their prisoner, who had been hiding behind the rum casks with his ears flapping. Faced with the choice of rotting on a desert island or hitching a ride, the colonel had reluctantly chosen the latter, and now he drags himself blasphemously from the water, sucks his thumbs with little whimpers, and finally disappears appropriately, rat-like, through a dark hawse hole. But while all these portentous events are breaking loose on Aves, what of our hero Ben? We last saw him in Vladimir's shop, blushing hotly as he goggled through play wench, while the conniving little crook prepared the contract under which he agreed to kit out our captain for his anti-brotherhood campaign in return for a 90% cut. Whew! Of all prize money, loot, rewards, and kindred lettuce which might accrue, from which you will deduce that Avery, his mathematical tripot notwithstanding, was no whiz at the fine print, as what respectable hero is, and that Vladimir's spiritual home was Pico Boulevard, with private lines to the valley and Culver City, hovering like an unwashed guardian angel, as Avery inscribed his copperplate signature, the happy shyster gloated silently at the prospect of ginormous profits. Like Lady Vanity, he foresaw a golden future with his wagon hitched to Avery's shooting star, and lost no time in fulfilling his own side of the contract. Sort of. Which is how we now find Avery at sea, hundreds of leagues to leeward, and if a frown mantles his features as he scans the horizon, it's because he's had it up to here these past few days. For one thing, the first-rate man-o'-war procured by Vladimir looked suspiciously to our hero's trained nautical eye like a converted coal barge, and the 200 prime seamen were either from the Libertatia Remand Center, Vladimir had an understanding with the authorities, or had had to be dragged bodily from the YMCA by the press gang, whereof came black mischief within the first day's sailing, when the rum-vending machine broke down and bloody mutiny erupted, which Avery had had to quell in person and skinned his knuckles. Worse still, the vessel leaked abominably, and our hero had spent hours swimming alongside in heavy seas, laboring with plugs, oakum, buckets of tar, and scotch tape, do you see, while the crew bailed and pumped sulkily and hung around in groups discussing industrial action. Since then, they'd weathered a couple of hurricanes, beaten off a Sally Rover, lost their mizzen topmast. Avery had conducted a thorough investigation, but no one seemed to know where it had got to. Run aground on dreaded Cape Banana, by the powers, warped and garbled their way clear, revictualled at Port Fortnum, flogged the carpenter, for a quite decent price, actually, marooned a chronically intoxicated bosun on a sand spit with a loaded pistol and a latrine bucket, and after all these misadventures had finally beaten their way west to a point roughly there on the chart, or a little to the left. And all this because Avery, who had hoped to run down his quarry in African waters, had learned to his chagrin what we knew ages ago, that the pirates were off to the Caribbean. It was all in the kid stuff column of the Daily Lookie, Bilbo and Sheba listed as stateroom passengers on the Laughing Sandbag, with Firebeard traveling scupper class, Rackham bound for Tortuga in the Plymouth Corporation's Revenge, and the Frantic Frog headed for the Spanish Main via Aves. Those last two words had struck Avery as a remarkable coincidence, and reminded him that Vanity was expecting him back on Friday. Well, since he must lose no time pursuing his enemies, Friday was out. But he had prevailed on Vladimir to have her picked up and conveyed to the Cape, the promise which his rascally agent, who believed that the fewer dumb blondes Avery had to distract him from pirate hunting the better, conveniently forgot, with what dire consequences we know. Unconscious of Vladimir's knavish neglect, Avery had sailed west with a tranquil mind, assuaging his love-struck yearning for the admiral's daughter by writing her daily love letters, which he dropped overboard in bottles, telling himself it was the thought that counted. But our gallant hero's chief concern, as he paced the rotting poop of the rocketing Spitfire, the name which Vladimir had caused to be painted hurriedly over the legend West Hartlepool Dredging and Maintenance Company, was whether this decomposing hulk would be adequate to deal with the entire buccaneer fleet when he reached Tortuga. Assuming it stayed afloat that long, he didn't care for the way the ship's rats had taken to building their nests in the lifeboats. And the crew were undoubtedly restless. Here they came again, surging across the deck, bawling, "Avery out! Avery out!" firing pistols and hurling knives. A marlin spike whizzed past the captain's head and thudded into the mast, and he sighed irritably as he drove them back for the umpteenth time with flashing rapier and ringing command. "Down, sea scum, down, I say, to your kennels! Stop it, you rotters!" He disarmed one mutineer, pinked a second, kicked a third carefully above the belt, and KO'd a fourth with a perfect straight left. "It's action you want, is it, my bullies?"
"Action nothing!" roared a bearded ruffian, lunging with a boarding pike. "We want to go home!"
"Home, is it?" Athletically poised on the ladder, flicking back lace from immaculate cuff, Avery smiled proudly down on the snarling faces and glittering blades. "Traveling in style, three-course dinners, pockets stuffed with loot, is that what you want, eh?" It gave the scoundrels pause, plucking whiskers, rolling eyes, and spitting doubtfully.
"Aye," growled the boarding pike expert at last, "that would be favourite. I'd have to consult the membership-like, but in principle it sounds a right."
A suspicious growl from the crew confirmed him. They'd been here before.
"Can you guarantee these proposals will be implemented across the board?"
they chorused. Avery's reply was a gay, cheerful, not gay peculiar, laugh, and a whirling gesture of his rapier to point a beam.
"Right on," cried he gallantly. "There she is, fame, fortune, riches, dollars, all the grub you can eat, and a safe passage home. Eventually."
As one man they turned, and there it was, sure enough, a magnificent Spanish galleon, the sun gleaming on the gold paint of her beak and stern castle, and on the brazen muzzles of the tiers of cannon thrusting from her ports, towering sails and white pyramids of canvas, and the red and gold flag of Spain fluttering from her staff. She surged across the cobalt water, a veritable queen of the seas, and Avery's voice rang out again. "Fear not, my hearties, she's one of theirs, a proud and vaunting don, so there's nothing unethical about giving her the business. Yon be symbol of King Philip's tyranny. I warrant there's not a man aboard her who is C of E, or drinks honest ale, or can speak good English even. Furthermore, they're insufferably conceited, and have far more money than is good for them. Ho, trumpeter, sound to quarters, huzzah!" An echoing roar from 200 lusty British throats answered his stirring call to battle.
"Are you kidding? Attack that? They'll murder us! Nay, captain, we'm outgunned, outnumbered, out of our ever-loving minds if we venture broadsides with such as yon. 'Tis stark madness, belike, and looky!"
Bawling, they clamoured round the intrepid figure erect on the ladder, and his lip curled, and his fierce glance exploded on them in scornful sparks.
"Ha! What! Are ye British seamen or crawling curs?" "British curs," they roared, "so forget it."
But Avery was their master. With one lightning spring he was at the binnacle, a pistol plucked from his belt, and his jaw jutted with a determination little short of reckless.
"One more step," he shouted, "just one, or even a dirty look, and I blow the compass to pieces, and you'll never find your way home. Why, you illiterate rabble, you don't even know where you are, or which is north, or anything."
They checked their rush, muttering, some crying that north was over there, beyond the sharp end, others shouting, "No, no, you had to point the hour hand of your watch at the sun and divide by 2/5. Avery smiled grimly at their confusion.
"Choose, ye lubbers. It's sail round in circles till ye rot, or death to the dons, honour, glory, and money in the bank."
His dauntless bearing had its effect. With yells of panic, they flung themselves to the gun tackles, hurled up the ports, rummaged in corners for powder and shot, ran up the colors, thrust the helm hard over, let fly the sheets, and with defiant screams of anxiety, bore down on the startled Spaniard. Aboard the galleon was sudden bustle and shouting of words ending in O, donning of morions and blaring of trumpets, flapping of sails and strutting around the poop by proud figures in backs and breasts of polished steel with little forked beards and haughty faces, while across the azure sea the pride of the West Hartlepool coastal trade came racketing in like gangbusters, swarthy, bearded faces peering through the ports, teeth chattering, closing their eyes, fumbling for their matches and wishing they'd joined the army, belike. Poised on the rail, rapier in hand, head flung back, sleeves rolled up, flies securely buttoned, and the light of battle in his eye, Avery measured the narrowing distance to the enemy. "This is what we came in for. This is the moment, as the great sea castles run to meet each other, when the trumpets sound and Eric Wolfgang Korngold's music thunders to a crescendo that culminates in crashing broadsides, billowing smoke, spurts of flame, shots smashing into timber hulls, masts toppling, tangles of cord and canvas hurtling all over the place, smoke-blackened faces glaring, voices screaming, decks shuddering, and Perhaps, in some more sober moment, we might spare a grateful thought for the nameless scoundrels who, for the basest of motives, no doubt, broke the power of Spain in the Western Oceans in just such actions, and all unwittingly made the world a better place to live in before they went to their unhonored account, leaving behind as their own memorial only the doughnut, which they invented, and a pantomime figure with a patch over its eye, a scarf round its beetling brows, and a parrot on its shoulder. But for the moment, it's all romantic blood and thunder as the rocketing Spitfire, its sides torn with shot, the water pouring into its hold, its masts gone, its powder spent, its forecastle furniture damaged beyond repair, and even the rats huddled forlornly in a corner, squeaking in unison something that sounds like, "We'll meet again." Crashes were rending timbers into the Spaniard's stern. Locked together in the battle smoke, the two ships swing together, and this is where Avery earns his money, as with a yell of, "Follow me, men, and remember it's a foreign ship, so behave as you would at home," he launches himself rapier first into the mob of mustachioed grandees on the quarter-deck. For a moment he is alone, with his crew shouting, "Good riddance!" and trying frantically to cast off, but as they realize that the rocketing Spitfire is finally giving up the ghost and sinking beneath their feet, they opt for the only solid surface in sight and pour in a yelling wave over the galleon's bulwarks. Well, that's it. Never, in romantic fiction, has a horde of buccaneers roaring, "Belag!" and "Arg!" and "Where's the purser's office, Jack?" stormed the decks of a galleon with any results but one, and the dons knew it perfectly well. They thrust and parried haughtily for a minute or two, crying, "Caramba!" and subsiding with blood on their ruffles, while their inferiors did a bit of pushing and shoving on the main deck before scuttling away in search of safety, life jackets, and white flags. But once Avery, fencing athletically with that eager, fighting smile dazzling the opposition, had skewered a couple of hapless extras, engaged the Spanish captain, disarmed him with a masterly lunge and flick, presented his point courteously at the crestfallen Dago's throat, accepted his gasping surrender with a bow, and slashed the halyard which brought the red and gold banner flopping to the deck. Well, after that there was nothing for the Spaniards to do but throw down their weapons, draw themselves up proudly, mutter the Spanish equivalent of, "Sod this for a game of soldiers," and call it a day. With a wave of his hand to his exultant followers, and an indulgent, "All right, men, settle down now, and smoke if you want to," Avery turned to the stricken commander and explained in fluent Castilian that they needed his ship, that complaints could be forwarded to the Admiralty, Whitehall, SW1, and he would be obliged for the keys to the main cabin and officers' washroom. He then invited them to step over the side with such aplomb that they did so before it was realized that no lifeboats had been launched, and some confusion followed before this was remedied, and the disconsolate dons had been rescued and placed in inflatable dinghies with wet wigs and sodden finery. Some of the wilder elements in Avery's crew took advantage of this disorder to run out a plank forward and coax some of the prisoners off the end of it, but Avery soon put a stop to that. He summoned the boarding pike gorilla and addressed him sternly. "Belay that, Mr. Bellamy," he thundered. The gorilla's name was, in fact, Hector Smallpiece, but Avery knew what a buccaneer mate ought to be called, even if Hector's parents didn't. "Get that plank in at once before it's damaged, and never let it happen again. Plank walking is a Victorian fiction, and I won't have it aboard my ship, do you understand?" "Right. They can have 10 minutes to botch, and then I want the entire crew formed up for inspection. Kerchiefs straight, earrings polished, cutlasses clean, bright, and slightly oiled. Oh, and put out that blaze forward and straighten the mainmast. It's all crooked." "Aye, aye, Cap'n," bawled the beaming hooligan. "Will, and yearly, and bedamned in that. What, lads, arouse for Long Ben Avery with a curse?" at which the triumphant buccaneers roared their acclaim and threw up their sweaty nightcaps, toasting their lucky commander in the Perrier water, which their piratical instinct had already discovered in the galley stores.
"Make 'em go easy on that stuff, Bellamy," said Avery curtly. "It causes flatulence, and it's foreign, so heaven knows where it's been. And now I mind me, this vessel shall be known henceforth no longer as the Santa Cascara, but as—" He paused, and a tremor of emotion quivered his larynx, causing Bellamy to ponder slyly, "Hello, hello!" "As the Golden Vanity! So have it inscribed on bow and stern immediately." With that, he left them to tidy up and throw overboard all the litter of the battle, including any Spaniards who had got left behind, which they did while abusing the Perrier incontinently and bawling ribald songs. Avery went below to the luxurious compartments of the Spanish commander, cleaning his rapier fondly with Vanity's sweat rag, which he dropped in the laundry chute. He sighed deeply at the blue-eyed vision conjured up by that mundane act, blew a kiss to the empty air, and, feeling renewed and rededicated, breezed into the great stern cabin. A gasp of female agitation greeted him, and he stopped, amazed at the sight of two women crouched against the bulkhead. One was black and built along the lines of Hattie McDaniel. The other, well, suffice to say that even though his thoughts were full of Lady Vanity, the sight of her stopped Avery, bradoing, as though he had walked into an oncoming bus. How to describe those magical dark eyes, the glossy black tresses, the crimson parted lips, creamy skin, sweeping lashes, and girlish perfection of figure encased in a white lace gown, all blending into a mixture of virginal sweetness and gypsy wildcat. Call her a sort of Audrey Hepburn with Sophia Loren overtones, and you're not far out. Wild fear blazed in her eyes as she regarded Avery. "Stop!" she shrilled, and a slender stiletto gleamed in her tiny hand, poised over her snowy bosom. "Another step, and I will kill myself!" "I do beg your pardon," said Avery politely. "I had no idea the cabin was occupied, if you'll excuse me." And he was preparing to withdraw when she shrilled again, "Stop! Another step and I will kill—" She hesitated, grabbed Hattie by the hair, and flourished a poignard at her throat. "Her!" Avery frowned. "There seems to be some misunderstanding. I am Captain Benjamin Avery of the Royal Navy. I don't think I have the privilege of your acquaintance, miss."
"I am the most noble serene, and I class Donna Meliflua, etc., daughter of Don Miguel Alonso Bonanza Veranda, etc., knight of Santiago de Compostela, grandee of España," flamed the flashing-eyed beauty. "Lay a defiling finger on my person, or even raise your eyes in my direction, and you will answer to my hateful and loathsome betrothed, Don Lardo Baluna de Lobby y Corridor, Viceroy of the Indies."
"How do you do?" said Avery, and Donna Meliflua's wondrous eyes widened.
"You mean you are not going to, how you say in English, to ravish us? Helpless women that we are?"
"I must apologize for my intrusion," continued Avery, affecting not to hear her, "and for any inconvenience caused to your ladyship by the recent disturbance."
"We are not to be raped, or subjected to shame, or sold as slaves?"
Donna Meliflua's astonishment was such that she let go of her black maid, and Hattie gave one last squawk and fainted in a massive heap.
"But I not understand. You are endemonized heretical English pirate, and I am beautiful Spanish lady, and I am only 16.
She added indignantly.
"How is possible you don't want molester me?"
"I assure you, marm," Avery was beginning, when a bearded face appeared at the open stern window, flourishing a paintbrush.
"How many ends in Vanity?" it asked.
One, snapped Avery. Idiot.
Ta, said the face, and disappeared.
Donna Mellifluous placed one snowy hand on her lissome hip and put her head on one side.
Who is this Vanity?
Avery went faintly pink.
A lady of my acquaintance, he explained stiffly,
and Donna Mellifluous placed a dainty pinky between her flawless teeth and smiled.
Now I understand. She is your beloved, she frowned. Yet she cannot be more beautiful nor me. So I still think it very strange you don't want to...
If I may say so, marm, said Avery, shocked. Such froward talk ill becomes lady of your years and quality, especially one who is, as ye inform me, betrothed to the Viceroy of the Indies. Howbeit, he added, and could not refrain from bestowing a brotherly smile on this gorgeous, if eccentric, young puppet, you need fear not that we should have taken your ship, I regret, but be assured that my first essay will be to lay course for Cartagena and deliver you safely to your betrothed in two shakes of a duck's rudder, as we sailors. A shriek, as of escaping steam, interrupted him. Donna Mellifluous's splendid eyes blazed like bonfires, her fists clenched, her bosom heaved, her proud head tossed and her tiny foot stamped. My God, thought Avery, she's not going to do the Mexican hat dance.
I ate him, she spat. He is gross pig. What I shall never marry, never, never, never. Not for a million papas and mamas, so there. I am told he is old, this Don Lardo, and a blubbery bladder of bull droppings. I shall die before I submit my virgin sweetness to his disgusting embraces.
And to Avery's concern, she hurled herself on the sofa and began to feed short-arm jabs to the cushions. Then she wrenched off a shoe and broke a mirror with it, kicked Hattie McDaniel's prostrate form, and set about the cabin upholstery with her stiletto, sobbing hysterically.
Ah, said Avery. Well, I'll just send the steward down with some tea, shall I? And perhaps your ladyship will condescend to honour me with your company at dinner. 7:30 for 8. Quite informal. No need for long gloves. My respects, marm. He withdrew amidst a crashing of crockery and screams in Spanish schoolgirl slang, which he was rather glad he didn't understand. But it was a very different Donna Mellifluous who presented herself on the stern gallery that evening, where Avery had made free the Spanish captain's snowy napery, choice crystal, and EPNS a Toledo for her entertainment. As the Santa Cascara glided over the ultramarine surface of the Carib Sea for distant Cartagena on the main, while the crew were all forward watching the in-voyage puppet show, and only dusky stewards hovered round the table, and the ship's steel band waited, concealed behind a canvas screen, the imperious Spanish half-pint emerged from her cabin all demure delicacy in gown of scarlet satin, diamonds a price twinkling neath her mantilla, a fan of black lace concealing her face south of those coyly downcast eyes. Avery seated her with all solicitude, but don't for a moment think that he was going to all this bother with any improper intentions, certainly not. He was simply behaving as an English gentleman should, and if you imagine that his pash for the absent Vanity was in any way abated by the presence of the luscious Spaniard, you don't know our Ben. Solid worth, that's what he is, indeed, as he helps her to the hors d'oeuvres and watches her set about the sardines and Scotch eggs with Latin daintiness. His regard is positively patronizing. I mean, she's just a child, jolly pretty, no doubt, but probably not much past the teddy bear stage and not in Vanity's street. He set himself to put her at ease, answering her occasional shy murmurs with descriptions of his naval career, with a few digressions about trigonometry, cricket, and his dogs Buster and Doodles. And she listened wide-eyed,
interest coloring the creamy texture of her skin, her satin lips parted in admiration, her slender fingers drooping in wonder, and her white shoulders gleaming with attention. Presently, when the waiters had cleared away, they took their coffee and pettifors, standing side by side at the stern rail, while the phosphorescent wake of the ship creamed beneath them, the balmy air mingled with Donna Mellifluous' haunting perfume, and the hidden steel band played a soft samba arrangement of What Shall We Do with the Drunken Sailor? And now, having won her girlish confidence, Avery tactfully turned the talk to their destination and her impending union with Dunlardo. You see, dear Mellifluous, I'm sure your mummy and daddy know best, he told her. And he's probably quite a nice chap for a dig, I mean for a viceroy. You don't get that kind of job unless you're a sound man, you know. Anyway, when we get close to Cartagena, it may be slightly tricky, since I, as enemy of thy country, though sure friend to thy sweet self, if you'll pardon the familiarity, must ashore in secret to see how I may best convey thee to him without creating a diplomatic incident. Don't want to embarrass him, I mean, or get myself arrested, for that matter. He paused, his sailorly ears detecting the sound of splashing close at hand, and to his distress saw that great tears were plopping into her cleavage. Pity seized him, and he seized her, just by the hand, and in fond concern. She raised her lovely face towards him, her lips trembling like red plastic cushions, and breathed a scented sigh, what time another pearly drop rolled from her perfect lid. "Oh, Capitan Ben," she murmured, and he thought, "what a dashed nice thing to call him. You are so kind to poor little Mellifluous, and yet so cruel. If you only knew what a vile dog's dinner is this Don Lardo, and I am but a tender maid, but—" she heaved another sigh, which knocked her coffee cup off the rail. What must be, I suppose. But how I envy your vanity, who may marry as her heart chooses. At mention of that magic name, Avery raised his eyes to where it had been painted on the stern overhead. There it was, Gladden Vatney. Oh, well, he thought, you can't win them all. And turned again to regard the sweet resignation of the lovely flyweight at his side. Gosh, what a ripping little sport she was, taking it on the chin this way, and what a cad Don Lardo must be to constrain her, and she such a decent pippin. Why, he thought, if he were a Dago himself, perish the thought, but just suppose, he couldn't ask for a better kid sister than young Mellifluous. And wouldn't his Dago pals cluster round her just with those gorgeous eyes and jolly attractive little mouth and silky hair and swan-like neck and smooth shoulders and things? Awfully nice, really. Mellifluous shivered.
Oh, but I am chilly. No, I like it out here. Perhaps if you hold your coat round my shoulders, that is more comfortable, thank you.
And she gave him a timid smile of sisterly gratitude and snuggled up.
Ah, your vanity is so lucky. If my parents were kind like hers, I might have married Jaime or Andrea or Pedro or Rodrigo or Arturo or Ricardo or Alfonso or Juan or any of the gang who used to play their guitars beneath my window, and throw flowers and confectionery and love tokens and boxes of fruit to my balcony.
Good eggs, were they? Said Avery sympathetically.
Not eggs, fruit, I say. But none of them, she added pathetically, laying her head on Avery's shoulder, was the man of my dreams.
Her glowing eyes misted, and she stifled a glooping sob.
I used to pray I might meet him.
What was he like? Asked Avery, smiling indulgently.
Ah, he was my Cid, my caballero, about 6'2", I think, with broad shoulders, yet so slim and elegant, what you in English call a lovely little mover, with light brown hair and a chin so proud and eyes like..." She was gazing up at him intently. "Yes, like a clear grey sky. Oh, and so handsome and strong and kind and brave and sexy."
"My, you're what we English call well away," smiled Avery. "Ah, little Mellifluo, I know not where such paragon might be found, save in fond poetical romance. But I tell thee what, if I knew a chap like that, hanged if I wouldn't introduce you. Don Lardo or no Don Lardo, because you're such a stout little fella, you deserve this dream chap of yours, honestly. And if he comes along, well, just you collar him, is my advice, and I'll be the first to weigh in with a toast rack as a wedding pres..." Mellifluo gave an ecstatic yip and a crooning moan, and an amazed Avery found slender arms about his neck, warm lips opening moistly on his own, and a lissome form glued to his frontage. "Hold on," he thought, "I only said if, so you needn't be so grateful for a purely hypothetical promise, you dear, giddy little goose." Really, she was a most impulsive child, but he mustn't appear unsympathetic. What awfully pleasant perfume these Spanish gels used. He'd have to ask her what it was and get some for Vanity. Why should it make him think of throbbing guitars and castanets and Donna Mellifluo dancing in that rather abandoned way? Pity her dream chap didn't exist, because she'd look absolutely stunning in bridal white with a lace veil and a red rose clenched between those tigerish little teeth. Heavens, she'd fainted. At least she'd come unglued and was lying limp in his arms with her eyelids fluttering, muttering some nonsense about thunderbolts and prayers being answered. Fagged out, of course, poor kid, after a trying day, and he'd kept her up far too late. With a cheerful, "Come on, young stager, beddy byes," he swung her easily up in his arms, carried her to her cabin, and turned her over to Hattie McDaniel with a courteous kiss on the hand and a brotherly pat on the cheek. But she just stared at him in a trance-like sort of way, totally bushed, obviously. Well, the sooner he delivered her to Don Lardo, and she got those Mills and Boone notions about handsome cavaliers out of her girlish head, the better. One couldn't but feel sorry for the little squirt, but there it was. He took a last look round to see the masts were straight and the ship pointing the right way, and found his thoughts straying fondly to Vanity, as usual. Dear Vanity! With her silky blue-black hair and dark, appealing eyes. Half a sec. Had he got that right? Well, near enough, probably. He'd had a long day himself. So, likewise, If Avery wasn't such a straight shooter, we might wonder if the strain wasn't beginning to tell at last. Has he succumbed to the Latin charms of the gorgeous Spaniard? No, he's just confused, which is nothing to what he'll be when he discovers that Vanity has become a brunette indeed, always assuming the dye job lasts, and she ever escapes the besotted clutches of Happy Dan Pugh. As for Mellifluo, who can blame the impressionable chit for falling for Avery like a ton of nutty slack, especially when the alternative is the repulsive Don Lardo, whom we'll meet in a minute? If he wasn't such a snurge, one could almost feel sorry for Lardo, what with his fiancée going sour on him, and Bilbo and Sheba planning him evil despite, which is what they're doing e'en now.